This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. Signature support from Subaru of Baton Rouge. And over the weekend, we had another election. Unfortunately, another low turnout, about 23%. But congratulations to the three people who won statewide, all Republicans: Liz Merle, Attorney General; Nancy Landry, Secretary of State; John Fleming returns to office in Louisiana as the state treasurer, and all of them will be inaugurated with the governor on January 8th. And the new governor will be Jeffrey Martin Landry, who is a graduate of Loyola's law school. And we've got a guy here who's kind of the king of trivia about a lot of things, Tom Galligan, former president of LSU, former dean of the law school, still teaches at the old war school at the law center. But I think the last person to graduate from Loyola Law School to be governor of Louisiana was Earl Long.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And
Earl of Louisiana.
Yeah, the Earl of Louisiana. But we've got Tom Galligan, who not only led LSU, and by the way, for those of us who enjoy engaging personalities, he's a guy who, shall we say, is a bit more lively than the current guy, but Bill Tate's, as you know, got a tough job. You commented that it's tough having both positions, president and chancellor, and I see where Southern may divide their leadership. But what about the enormous responsibility of running not only the main campus, but all the other campuses, the med school? It's a full plate, isn't it?
It is a huge job. It takes 7 days a week, 24 hours a day almost.
But you liked it.
Yeah, I liked it. It was an adventure. And you know, I thought I knew LSU, having taught at the Law Center, having been the dean of the Law Center. But I learned so much about the Baton Rouge campus, but about the seven other parts of the LSU family that, it was absolutely fascinating.
Well, Professor Galligan, former President Galligan, former Dean Galligan, and by the way, he also was at high places at other universities. He was president of Colby Sawyer College and dean and professor of law at the University of Tennessee. So he is a man who is known well, and for good reason, in academia, and educated at extremely high levels, degrees from Stanford, Seattle University, and Columbia University, and a native of Glen Ridge, New Jersey. And he is a baseball aficionado. And New Jersey is a place, of course, that often gets lost in the shuffle. But those who are from New Jersey take great pride. I know, of course, produced the greatest singer in Frank Sinatra, but I'm sure you're very proud of where you grew up.
I'm incredibly proud of being from New Jersey, and I mean, there are a lot of smart people from New Jersey, and many of us have left.
Bruce Springsteen's from New Jersey,
too. Bruce Springsteen's from Freehold, New Jersey, absolutely.
Yeah, the great names from New Jersey. You remember the pitcher, since baseball is one of your things, from Tom's River, New Jersey?
Pitcher from Tom's
River. Tom's River, New Jersey.
Kurt Schilling, but I'm not, I don't no. know.
He's Andy Messersmith.
Oh, Andy Messersmith, one of the first two free agents.
That's right.
Yeah, Andy Messersmith.
1975,
yeah.
And the other one was?
What's it, Jim McNally?
Dave McNally.
Dave McNally from the Orioles.
That's right, but Messersmith signed with the Braves.
Yep.
And Ted Turner had just bought the Braves, and Messersmith, the first game, he's wearing 17. And remember, Turner's station was then WTCG, Channel 17. Instead of saying Messersmith 17, first game it said Channel 17, and Bowie Kuhn said, no more Channel 17. Got to be Messersmith 17. But how about Aaron Nola? Catholic High guy, LSU guy, 30-5 in his career at LSU. Greatest pitcher in LSU history, and signed yesterday. What was the deal?
Yeah, what was it? 7 years, $170-some million, about $24 million a year, and good for Aaron Nola. Showing was getting paid very well, but at least the rumors are that he turned down more from some other teams to go back to the Phillies. I know that you are a Phillies fan, so you got to be pleased that he's coming back.
And you're a Red Sox fan.
I'm a Red Sox fan.
And it took a while, but the Red Sox, they got on a roll there. But as a kid, I was nine in 1967. Jim Lomborg, remember him?
Jim Lomborg, Stanford grad.
That's right.
And I was actually... We took a vacation to Cape Cod. We spent 2 weeks in Cape Cod in the summer of 1967, and I was a Yankee fan, And here I was in Cape Cod in a hotel, and every night I would sit with these folks, many of them retired folks, and watch the Red Sox. And so I fell in love with that impossible dream team. And,
1967.
And, yep, Carl Yastrzemski, Triple Crown, Jim Lomborg.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right. I bet you can name the starting lineup.
Ooh, I'm not sure I could name the whole starting lineup. I'd go Lomborg would be my starting pitcher. They traded for Elston Howard late in the season.
They did, the former Yankee, of course.
Yeah, the Boomer, George Scott, would have been
first base.
Mm-hmm. Mike Andrews would have been
at second base. You know, shortstop, got to know.
Oh, Rico Petrosella.
That's right.
Joe Foy. Yastrzemski.
Mike Ryan was a catcher, too.
Mike Ryan was a catcher. Reggie Smith was in center field.
From Shreveport, Louisiana.
And then Tony Conigliaro.
That's it. You got him.
Bean sat out. And Ken Harrelson and Joe LaHoy.
They got Harrelson late in the season.
Yes.
But the number two pitcher starter was Jose
Santiago. Yes. Who won game six against the Cardinals in the series to set up game seven.
And Lomborg lost to Gibson in game seven.
And then went skiing with Jill St. John and injured his knee and was never the pitcher,
but he was a gamer. He hung around for a long time, played with the Phillies, of course.
Yep.
Won 17 games in 1974, and then he won 18 in 76 for the Phillies. And you know what? In 83, when he was 41 years old, he had gone back and he became a dentist.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Smart guy.
When that team gets back together, he's one of the sort of catalysts of it, I understand.
Well, and he's also born in 1942. Now, see, he was, you know, when I was a little kid, your mind's like a sponge. 41642. So what does that make him? 81 years old.
Yeah.
James Reynold Lomborg.
Yeah, Jim Lomborg.
877-217-5757 for Thomas. What's the C?
Clavin.
Clavin.
My
Tom Clavin. There's a great writer named Tom Clavin.
Yep. It's my father's mother's maiden name.
Thomas C. Clavin Jr.
Yes.
The pride of Glen Ridge, New Jersey. Is that near New York City?
Yeah, it's very near. 12 miles. And really, I was born in Glen Ridge. The hospital was in Glen Ridge. But Montclair is right next door. And so I claim Montclair as my home. But my legal birthplace, the maternity ward of the hospital, was in Glen Ridge.
877-217-5757. Stephen in Jefferson. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi,
you're on with Tom.
Hi, Jim, and hi, Tom.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say I had some good times in Montclair, New Jersey, playing guitar. Did you guys get Al Leiter on your list?
Get who?
Al Leiter.
Was Al Leiter was
Tom's Rib, New Jersey.
Oh, he's from Tom's River, too. I did not know that, but he shares that distinction with Andy Messersmith.
Now, Steve, we also have, I think, if not from Tom's River, from close by, is Joe Theismann, whose name at Notre Dame was changed to Theismann, and Drew Pearson, I think, are from the area as well.
Yep, you're correct. Steve must be a New Jersey guy.
Baton Rouge guy who spent 15 years in New Jersey and the 14th winter was the one that
Steve, I had a similar experience in New Hampshire. I loved it, but about the fifth winter, I realized that winter in April is just a bad joke.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks for calling, Steve. Now, there's this perception that people on the East Coast might be a little smarter than those in this part of the country. The politics, of course, are much different, not only the climate, but the politics. Is any of that true, or is that overplayed?
I think what's true is that the climate is different.
Other than that,
not at all. I'll sing the praises of LSU and the LSU Law School. The students at the LSU Law Center are absolutely the best students I have ever taught. I've taught great students in Tennessee, fabulous students in New Hampshire, but they're smart, they work hard, they're dedicated, they're fun to be with. So I'd hold my students at the LSU Law Center in terms of intelligence and work ethic up against anybody in the world.
And you were head of the school, head of the whole school, and of the Law Center. And now the Law Center, we not only have the outgoing governor, John Bel Edwards, but one of his classmates, Mike Johnson, is now Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. That's high cotton.
That is definitely high cotton. That's something. And yeah, Mike Johnson, I taught Mike Johnson torts. Well, I should say Mike Johnson was in my torts class. He might have learned it on his own, but I taught him torts many years ago.
And you have been at LSU now for how long?
I think, Jim, I've been at LSU. We got to do the math. If you add up my two stints, this is probably 18, 19 years.
More than any other place.
More than any other place. I started my teaching career at LSU and taught here for 12 years and then kind of wandered in the field and came back in 2016.
Paul in Denham Springs. Paul, you're on with Professor Galligan. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. I was just wondering if Mr. Galligan, if TOPS or let me rephrase it this way. I feel like a lot of young folks, they're losing faith in universities and the government. Could you maybe sell the narrative?
All right. We will ask Dean Galligan about TOPS, which now doesn't have as many people taking it as we used to, back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Tom Galligan, former dean of the LSU Law Center and former president and chancellor of the university. He was succeeded by Bill Tate for the job as president, and he was succeeded by Alina Allen, who was with us a few weeks ago, a sharp person who we wish well as dean of the LSU Law Center. But before we hit the break, Paul in Denham Springs, and by the way, you can get in with Dean Galligan if you'd like to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757 is our number. But what about TOPS? And this is a great benefit for Louisiana high school students. And yet, over the last few years, the numbers show that fewer people are taking it. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on. I think Paul sort of led in by saying that maybe folks have lost some faith in higher education. And, you know, I guess I'm one to testify that higher education is sort of the pathway to a new horizon. I mean, it changes everything for your whole family. My dad was first generation college, and I there was no question in my life I was going to college. College graduates still do better over the long run in terms of the jobs they get, the earnings they have across the span of their lifetime. A college education, when you look up at the stars, you can understand what's going on a little bit. You're not just mystified. When your doctor tells you your gallbladder's not working out, you understand it. When you vote, you're maybe a better informed voter. So obviously I'm a huge fan of higher education and what it can do for people, both quantitatively and qualitatively.
Jim on Airline Highway. Jim, you're on with President, Dean, and Professor Galligan. Hi, Jim.
Good morning, gentlemen. I think one of the problems is that TOPS just isn't enough. There's too many other states which are offering much larger financial packages to the best and brightest coming out of high school in Louisiana. And TOPS just doesn't cut it. That's what I get from lots of parents.
All right. Well, Jim, he is right. I hear the University of Alabama, for example, they offer kids here great things to defect.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we offer great scholarship packages, too. But, you know, I think Jim's probably hit on something is the competition. The competition is fierce. You know, we want to keep our best and brightest in Louisiana if they want to stay here for higher ed. And if they don't, well, then come on back for law school, for med school, for business school. But the competition is fierce, and we know that as we look out, there's a bit of a demographic cliff for young people who are going to be headed to college because there's going to be fewer of them. So the competition is just going to get even more intense.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Tom on Bluebonnet asked Tom Galligan, what makes a good lawyer?
That's a great question, Tom, and you have a wonderful name. I would say first and foremost, you have to be able to listen. You need to hear what people are saying. And you need to be able to hear not just the words, but between the words. So listening, and then reading comprehension, critical thinking, the ability to write. Even lawyers who say, "Well, I want to be a courtroom lawyer," you've got to be able to write to be a lawyer. And I think you've got to be able to understand multiple perspectives and different types of people, and a little bit of compassion goes a long way.
That's a good answer. Bill Huey says, if you could change the LSU board composition, what would you do? Or, and also its policies and practices. You had to answer to a board, and I guess indirectly you still do. Is the LSU board a good way to run the university?
Well, you know, I had a group of absolutely wonderful board members, and I enjoyed working with them very, very much. They meet very often. So I guess if I were reinventing the world, one of the things that I would look at would be frequency of visits. Another thing I think to think about is their student representation, which is a wonderful thing, but there's no faculty or staff official representation. I think the board listens to the faculty and staff folks who talk to them, but that'd be another thing if one were redrawing the lines to take a look at. A couple of years ago, Senator Fields proposed an amendment to the Constitution to allow at least one board member on each of the state's higher ed boards to be from out of state, and that it did not pass. It's good to be loyal to our state and the folks in our state, but maybe having one board member from out of state wouldn't be such a bad idea.
Well,
it was called the Lod Cook Amendment.
Because he could have been a great board member, but he was living in California.
Exactly.
But I think you're on to something. For example, you would make a great board member now. You know the university. You know everything about it. You have knowledge that would be exceptional if that were the practice. But generally, as we know, those board positions are political paybacks. Now, the people on there are generally qualified, and most of them have a connection and love for LSU. But it would be nice to have somebody who's seen it from the inside out.
I think it wouldn't hurt.
It wouldn't hurt. 877-217-5757 in our remaining time with Tom Galligan. And then it's Dr. Henry Barham, one of the foremost ear, nose, and throat specialists who has cutting edge research that he showcased a few years ago regarding COVID. And his research has been backed up. But Tom Galligan is a guy of many interests, and he's run 20 marathons. And you told me your best time was...
My best time was 3:29, which is about 8 minutes a mile.
For 26.2 miles.
For 26.2 miles. I haven't run one in a few years. I'm mostly a walker now. And I've got to say that my oldest daughter, Sarah, has shattered my three... I think hers is 3:29, but I think she's got the family record by about 20 seconds.
But 3:29, 8 minutes. Try running one 8-minute mile.
I couldn't do it now.
You couldn't?
No.
Well, does that tear up your knees, your joints, when you do it as much as you did?
You know, I'm lucky. My knees are in pretty good shape. My hips are in pretty good shape. So I guess I was made for distance. So I'm lucky. But it takes persistence. How's that? It takes being a stubborn person to run that many marathons.
Well, and. Let's see, here's Howlin' Monroe asked both of us the best baseball player in our lifetime. So it would not include Babe Ruth. So Babe's off the board, who I still think is the best of all time, but he played in a much different era, as we know.
He did, and he played in a segregated game. So,
that is true, Babe.
I have to answer. I want to be controversial, but I have to answer Willie Mays.
Willie Mays. And I would say his godson, Barry Bonds.
Okay, fair enough.
But Mays, I think that Mays and Aaron played at the same time. Clemente, I mean, it was Mantle.
Yep. Carl Yastrzemski.
Carl is underrated. He was a great player, and his misfortune was he followed Ted Williams.
Yeah. And then Jim Rice followed him. So imagine trying to crack into the top four.
Well, Williams on base percentage?
Unbelievable.
482.
Yeah.
Best of all time.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
And they nailed him twice. He served in World War II and Korea. He lost 5 years.
And imagine what his career statistics in terms of home runs, RBIs, hits would have been.
And he
with
played
those
in a park that was not conducive for a left-handed batter either.
That's exactly right.
In fact, he should have been in New York, and DiMaggio should have been in Boston, and there was talk of trading them.
There was, but imagine being the general manager and trading either one of those two.
But James and Metairie, we're going to slide you in before we hit the break and go to Dr. Barham. I know you've been waiting a little bit. James, you're on with Dr. Galligan. Hello, James.
Good morning, Jim. Let me turn my sound down if I can't hear it. Real quickly, alarm bells should be going off in academia. I hope a lot of people understand what Donald Trump is proposing, an American academy, free universities. He says they're turning our current administrations and schools are turning our students into communists.
All right. Well, he didn't do so well with Trump U, but the former president, who's a graduate of Penn, he apparently doesn't like the current state of academia in America, which is supposedly polluted by liberals. Your 5-10 second response?
Yeah, I think we try to be as balanced as we can. I've never tried to convince anybody to think like me, think for themselves.
Thank you, Tom Galligan. Back with Henry Barra. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we segue to Dr. Henry Barham, one of the foremost ear, nose, and throat specialists in the United States. He's been doing his thing for a while, BS from LSU, MD from LSU Health Sciences in Shreveport, and he is known around the country for cutting-edge research. And we had him on this show. It's been 3 years now. This was when COVID was, of course, a big part of the fabric of our country and our world. And Dr. Barham at the time was disclosing that he had a taste test that he believed could determine whether somebody was more susceptible or perhaps not susceptible at all to COVID. And that story kind of went by the wayside, but it has been backed up by peer review. And Dr. Barham, let's start there. Do you feel like your research has been vindicated over the last few years?
I do. It's been kind of a fascinating ride. It was never isolated directly to COVID. So we have continued to study it to upper respiratory infections. You know, prior to COVID, we actually had studied it to inflammatory diseases and bacterial infections in the upper airway. COVID was just an incredible scenario for research with, obviously a novel virus provides just incredible opportunity for research. And so we have continued to evaluate it to other upper respiratory infections and have ongoing trials. And the data still holds up. Obviously, anything new in medicine, you shouldn't and can't utilize it on a worldwide basis until it's proven and has gone through all reviews, but we have done that, as you mentioned, have gone through peer review for those initial couple of studies, but have continued to study it and have an upcoming very large trial for upper respiratory infections in general.
Well, for those who didn't hear the previous program or haven't heard you or read about you in other places,
yes, sir.
How does it work?
Well, for those, basically what we study is a family of receptors that they do influence taste, but they are part of your innate immunity. And so really, there's two types of immunity. There's innate immunity and adaptive immunity. Adaptive is what you develop over a lifetime. And vaccines and prior infections influence that. But innate immunity is your baseline kind of barrier of defense that you're born with. So the family of receptors that we're studying are really part of innate immunity. And so basically, high level of expression of these receptors allows you to have less of a risk to severe infection because you have a larger barrier of defense out of the gate versus if you have low expression of the receptors, you're sort of more have the potential for a worse infection because you have less of a level of protection. And so what we did was we were able to isolate which receptors matter, and you basically do a taste test to measure for those receptors, and then that's predictive of your illness. And so that's kind of how that was the background of how all the COVID stuff started, and then now we've gotten into upper respiratory infections in general.
So you're saying that the research for COVID has carried over to other viruses and maladies, and how does it work? Like, if you have a strong sense of taste, does that give you less of a chance?
Really. No, it's kind of a misnomer. It unfortunately, the the receptors or the terminology, you know, originally was called super tasters and stuff. And it does influence taste, but it's not really accurate to say, oh, I have a great sense of taste, because it's more about your level of expression of these specific receptors. And there are specific tests that you can take to measure for them. But it's not like someone saying, oh, I have a great sense of smell and taste, so I know that I'm not going to get infected. I wouldn't suggest using that as a marker.
Well, you took your own test, didn't you?
I did.
And what did it show?
Well, I admittedly, I was kind of cheating. So I've studied these receptors dating back to, I worked after medical school. I trained in Colorado and then Australia before moving back to Louisiana. But in one of the labs that I worked in Colorado, they were the primary lab or the preeminent lab sort of studying these receptors or a specific type of receptor in rodents. And we were able to isolate them in humans in 2011 and 2012. And so I've studied these since then, as I said earlier, to upper respiratory infections and to bacterial and inflammatory conditions. And so I knew where I stood both genetically and on phenotypic tests. And so when I say phenotype, what that's doing is a taste test is measuring your outward expression of your genetics. And so it's a kind of an easy, a real-time test to see where you lie. And so to your specific answer, I have very high expression of these receptors. But that was part of the idea of why we wanted to study it to COVID, because I wasn't getting COVID or I wasn't contracting COVID despite very high exposure to it, you know, was working in the hospital, dealing with airways and people with COVID, and I just wasn't contracting.
You never got it. Never did.
Well, I have antibodies to it, so I guess I got it at some point, and true antibodies to it. So I, you know, but I never had symptoms. And so that was kind of the idea. Like I don't believe that anyone is fully immune to COVID, but certainly with varying degrees of severity. And that's really what the research was centered around.
Well, it is interesting that some people were exposed to people with COVID, as was I. And I went to gyms and restaurants, and we never shut down the office here. And we had people, of course, who got it. But to my knowledge, I never did. Or if I did, it was a very mild case. Now, is that something that's you hear a lot, and maybe your research is a reason why, if I had it, I didn't know it?
Well, that's certainly what the data would suggest. I will say that, and still, you know, I think the burden is still on us to prove it. Like anything in medicine, you know, we've done now several trials, several thousand patients involved in the trials, and then we're about to start a much, much larger scale trial. Not just here in Baton Rouge, but on a larger location, and with certainly more participants. But you know, that's the beauty of research is time and data will show the truth.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org for Dr. Henry Barham, known as one of the top ENTs in the country. And Holly in the Garden District asks about research that she hears you've done in wine country. What is this about?
Yeah, so this is certainly more fun than COVID. I will say that out of the gate. So basically what we've done there is, while COVID, we were looking at the specific receptors to immunity, what we've done on other true taste products. So we basically have looked at, if we take wine, what are the specific components of wine that give it its taste? And then said, okay, well, which specific taste receptors matter for those? And so specific in wine, you basically have tannins that give it the bitterness, and that's the kind of naturally occurring products, whether it be from the seeds or the skin or the leaves to the specific grape. That's what really gives the bitter components versus residual sugar. After the fermentation process, you have this residual sugar. And so you basically, what we did was figure out which bitter receptors matter for tannins and which sweet receptors matter for residual sugar. And then we have now created a test, which actually is, as of recently, is now available But the goal there was to try to make it just easy for the wine industry. And what we've found is that most people buy wine the same way. They walk into a store, they get overwhelmed because there's 10,000 bottles, and they basically buy a label that looks neat and a price point that they can afford, and they hope that they like it. And so that was kind of the beauty of this test is it's 2023. We feel like this is, for me, it's fascinating because I love smell and taste research. And I know that I don't think you could find a nerdier topic, but to me, it's so fascinating because the idea of being able to utilize that in a real world setting is incredible. So basically what you do is you take the test, it measures your specific receptors, and then the algorithm curates wine varietals or predictions on what you will like based on your specific receptors. And that is super fascinating.
Where do you take this though? This research is cutting edge, and you're applying it in various ways, but do you see this as kind of a wave of the future?
I certainly hope so. You know, analogous to like other neurosensory systems have done the same. Take vision, you know, many years ago, we didn't really know how to measure the curvature of lens or the rods and eyes. But now you go in for a simple vision screening and you can match glasses that literally open up your entire visual system. So your sensory input now is just so much further than it was 100 years ago. Well, we've never done that with taste. And so that's what the potential here is, that wine is the starting point. But what if you could measure your taste and then you tailor your diet and all the things that you take just based on what's specific for you? Because take wine. Wine's a good example. So another problem with wine is, in addition to not knowing what you like, most of the recommendations are by someone who really knows wine, right? And that's how it should be. They do know the wines. But the idea that they can recommend to a group of people is crazy, because that group of people are coming at it from all different angles. So there's no way that you take 10 people, there's no way they have the same taste receptors. So if you measure each of them specifically, well, then they could really make great recommendations, because they're going to match the wine directly to the person's palate for what their receptors are. And that's what this is. And so basically, yeah, people can order the kit. It's on VinoTaster. That's the company is VinoTaster. Mm-hmm. So it's like wine taster. There's no E because the receptors are TASTR. So like VinoTaster is the way it is. So, but you can order a kit. It comes to your house. You take the test. It's real time, so you don't have to send it off, and it makes your recommendations. And then you can actually order wine directly off of the app to ship to your house.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Dr. Henry Barham, and then we go to Smiley Gray Anders celebrating his birthday with us. This is Jim Inkster, and it's been too long. It's been 3 years since we talked to Dr. Henry Barham, who's one of the top ear, nose, and throat specialists in the United States, recognized for his research near and far. And then we're going to segue in a moment to Smiley Anders celebrating his birthday with us, the man of letters from The Advocate for 50 years now. But Stuart downtown, I know you've been waiting for Dr. Barham. You're on. Good morning, sir.
Well, Jim, Dr. Barham and Barham in the audience, good morning. Dr. Barham, being that the United States Constitution has no bearing on the viral and disease process, those in America who are hell-bent on not wanting to wear masks, want to congregate during a catastrophic pandemics like a COVID, what advice do you have for these people and lawmakers? And should they back off and soften their stance on the potential of infecting others?
All right. What about wearing masks? Is that something that should be imposed by our leaders, or should it be optional?
That's a difficult question. You know, fortunately, I'm not a political leader and not the one to have to make those decisions, because that's a tough one. But, you know, I can understand and have, you know, friends and family on both sides of the argument. It's a personal decision. But, yeah, I don't know that I have a stance either way politically. Mm-hmm.
Another listener, this one, Grace Grace in Goodwood asks about how you got into this research. What was the catalyst?
Into wine or COVID?
Well, the tasting part of it. When did all that start?
Yes, I mean, my practice, I practice rhinology. So I did ear, nose, and throat, and then fellowship in rhinology. So really my practice is dedicated to diseases of the nose and sinus, and so I do taste and smell research. And so part of that is dealing with these taste receptors. And so I've always been fascinated by research. You know, the joke is, you know, curiosity killed the cat that saved the career of a scientist. And so it provides me, I love research in the first place because it provides a great avenue of, I have a lot of questions and a way to try to sort through some of those and then even fun projects. Obviously the wine or vino taster project has been really fascinating. And that's been fun just to have a real world, example of something that we can really help people in an easy and fun way.
Is it true our noses get bigger as we get older?
They do. Cartilage continues to grow. And so your ears and your nose tend to be kind of more prominent as we get a little more distinguished.
And you do nose jobs, don't you?
I do. We'll do anything from functional to cosmetic, but yeah, it anything with the nose.
Yeah, my dentist did an x-ray a few months ago and said I had a deviated septum. And I don't have any issues as far as discomfort.
Yeah.
Is that common, or should I have somebody work on my nose?
No, it definitely is more common than people realize. I would argue, you know, if you're functionally, if you don't notice it, it's not a problem. It's more if it was causing problems with breathing or asymmetry with breathing or just inability to breathe through your nose. That's when you would fix it. But if you're not in noticeable problems, I wouldn't necessarily worry about it.
Okay. Well, Dr. Barham, it's been too long. Let's talk again soon. It's
absolutely
been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Congrats on the reception you have gotten for your research.
Hey, thanks so much.
Good man, and comes from good stock. Robert Barham, the longtime Politico, and his beautiful bride, Melba, they produced Dr. Henry Barham. Thank you, sir. And we're joined now by Smiley Gray Anders, the pride of Natchez, Mississippi. And it was 86 years ago on this date, November 20th, 1937, that Smiley Anders was born. And he, for the last 50 years, that's 50, has been writing for The Advocate. And come June 4th, it will be 45 years that he's had a six-day-a-week column. His items column has been awarded 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times best in the country, and it was victorious so often that I don't even think they present it anymore, the National Society of Newspaper Columnists, because Smiley Anders owned the category. But good morning to you, my dear friend Smiley Anders.
Good morning, Jim. I see you're using the column to get free medical advice now. I mean, the show, not the column. I've got column.
Well, you know,
that's pretty nice. I was going to ask him a few questions too, but I assume he's gone now. So,
Smiley, you've lasted 86 years, and I know that you're in relatively good shape. You survived COVID. But respiratory issues, of course, afflict us all. And my hero, Jack LaLanne, he said, "I'd be bad for my image, Jim, if I don't make it to 100. Well, he died at 96 with respiratory issues. He didn't make it to 100. But how does that affect you these days?
Well, I'm pretty much homebound. I'm on a oxygen tank. And I have to carry that around. It's got wheels on it, so I can get around, but I'm relying on Lady Catherine, and her sister Valerie is living with us too. And so they're two ladies are taking care of me and getting me in and out of the car. I'm not really driving much anymore. And so I'm kind of relying on them. But since I do the column mostly by email, it's, you know, I'm able to get all my material And so I'm able to do it every day. It's not really a problem. And so I enjoy it so much, too. It's almost like a hobby now, you know.
Well, it's an institution, and many thought that when the Advocate became the Baton Rouge and New Orleans Advocate, that Smiley would not play well in New Orleans, but you've found a whole new audience.
Yeah, I talked to some of the higher-ups at the Advocate and who came here from New Orleans, you know, from the Picayune, and they said they were surprised. They didn't really know about the column, and they said they were wondering if, you know, how, as you said, how it was going to play, but they said they were really surprised at the reaction, and I get at least half of my stories now out of the New Orleans and North Shore areas.
Mm-hmm.
The people there are just as crazy as the ones up here in Acadiana. So it's been really good for me. I get, you know, 50, 60 items a day, and I have to, you know, so it gives me a lot to choose from.
Well, as mentioned,
some of them are really funny too.
It started in Natchez for Smiley Anders, but he came to Baton Rouge, was a classmate at Estruma with Billy Ab Cannon, saw Billy's daughter Bunny this morning at Louie's, I was telling somebody the story, and I don't know if I got it right. Did you cheat off Billy, or did Billy cheat off you?
No, I cheated. I sat behind him in American history. That's the only class we had together. He was a year behind me in school, and he's a smart kid. Well, you know, he went to dental school and all that after football. And so I sat behind him, and I would I admit to taking a glance at his paper just to see if I had the same answer, because he did well in the high school and well college too.
He was a smart guy and a real character. And and lived about five lives in one. And like our frequent guest, Denny McLean, who's on this show every now and then, he went to prison. But he came out, and I think they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. He mellowed. He became the nicest guy in town. And as we know, when he was growing up, he was what they would call a badass.
Oh, he really was. Yeah, he was a tough kid. He was from a tough neighborhood, and there were some guys that didn't do well. You know, had some law enforcement issues. It was a blue collar area, blue collar school, and you know, the daddies worked at the plants mostly, and everybody was just home from the war. And it was a different time, really.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever get in fights?
Yeah. Huh?
Did you ever get in fights, some Smiley?
No, hell no. I weighed 125 pounds, and I mean, beating me up would have been no real big deal for anybody. They wouldn't have got any credit for that, you know. So what I did, I tried to be, you know, funny, and if somebody did give me trouble, I try to joke them out of it, you know, and I find somebody's laughing, he's not going to punch you.
Well, you've done that for a lot of years. I don't know of anybody who's more lovable than Smiley Anders, and Lady Catherine has been your great partner in life now for a generation, and tonight, where will the Anders celebrate birthday number 86?
Oh, we're going to a well-known steakhouse here, If I name it, will you have to send them a bill for advertising?
Well, it's got the same name as the bar you went to when John Kennedy was killed 60 years ago, right?
Yes, except for the ruse part. Yeah, right.
And they don't serve beer and fish bowls there.
No, they don't. I've never had a beer there, actually. They do a Hendrix martini.
So you'll have a martini tonight?
Incredible. I might well do that. I'm not really drinking very much anymore, but I do make an exception occasionally.
Well,
tonight is certainly the night for it.
Thank God for you, your column, and for staying the course, and best to you and Lady Catherine at your home in Spanish Town, now 100 years old, a little older than Smiley. Smiley, we love you. Keep going. Thanks for listening, everybody. We're back tomorrow. Stay safe. Stay tuned.